Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I don't know about you out there. If you're like me and stayed up most of the night to watch election returns, you might just want to get a hold of some of that NPR wine club wine today, or maybe you ought to stay as far away from it as you can. Look, this is a huge news day, not only because we have the results of the Atlanta mayor's election, some special legislative elections to talk about, interesting observations to be made about how women performed last night, how the LGBT candidates performed. We're going to talk about all of that. And then, of course, in the last hour, President Trump made official what we knew was coming, which was that he has officially now declared the United States recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, although he is not prepared to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem quite yet. We'll get to that a little bit later in the show. It's an important part of our conversation. So because we have so many important issues to discuss, we've got a full studio of great analysts today, starting with Melita Easters. She is the founder and director of the Georgia Win List, which is dedicated to identifying women who are pro-choice and Democratic leaning who want to run for public office. Did I say that well?
You said it well, and thank you for having me. It was a great night for us last evening.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. Also, next to you in the studio, Jared Yates Sexton is here. Jared, of course, teaches at Georgia Southern, but you're all of a sudden, you're a hot author. Your book, what is The People Are Going to Rise Like the Waters Upon Your Shore. Did I get that title right?
That's right.
But there's a secondary title.
Story of American Rage.
Rage. Jared, you haven't been on with us for a while, and I appreciate that you're up here from Georgia Southern to be part of this discussion today. Thanks.
Looking forward to it. Thank you, Bill.
By the way, you just told us before we went on the air that your book is now in its third printing and?
And a paperback coming out next year.
Oh, my God. Just wait for the movie. Mark Roundtree is here. He's the president of Landmark Communications and a Republican political consultant. Mark, it's been wonderful that you've been with us on a number of occasions throughout this election season, the mayor's race, and this is the perfect day to have you back. So thank you. Were you up most of the night?
Yeah, I had clients on the ballot yesterday, too, in Roswell, and so, yes.
How did you do?
They won.
Well, of course. So why would I even doubt that? And also joining us, Dove Wilker. Dove is are you director or executive director?
Regional director.
Regional director of the American Jewish Committee, the Atlanta or regional office here in the South. And the nice thing about you, Dove, is that there's nothing on the agenda today that you cannot talk with some perception about, but you can also really help us understand exactly what this decision by the president means in terms of the future of the Middle East.
Yeah, it's a tremendous day. It's a historic day. Three great days in a row as a New Yorker from, you know, Giants fan and soccer fan, and now, you know, recognition of Jerusalem. Great things come in threes.
All right, we'll see. I have a feeling that not everyone at the table is going to necessarily think it was a great decision, but that's part of why we wanted to have this conversation today. Let's start with the mayor's race, because it was a significant result last night. You know, Keisha Lance Bottoms appears to have won by 759
votes. Yes.
Astonishing. Out of some 93,000 cast. Let's first listen to what she said last night to her supporters at her victory party, and then we'll talk about it.
I look forward to engaging with each of you, making sure that our city continues to move forward. And for those who did not support me, I look forward to working with you as well.
So that's Keisha Lance Bottoms declaring victory, embracing victory. Mary Norwood, given the margin of 759 votes, told her supporters at her party she was not ready to give up yet.
I've done this before. The next few days single vote that has been cast is exactly reported out the way that it should be and will be, and we will know.
Mark, you polled this race extensively. We know that that for Keisha Lance Bottoms to win, she was going to have significant turnout from South and Southwest Atlanta to offset what we thought was going to be a big vote for Mary Norwood in Buckhead, Midtown, and East Atlanta. But how did all that play out?
Well, we of course, the state obtains the data of who voted, and then we're able to look and see the actual, you know, race and gender and age of the people who voted. The state won't release that for probably another 2 weeks. So right now we're basing this on supposition. It appears that in some of the Buckhead precincts, Norwood was not getting the runoff turnout that she got 8 years ago. I'll just list three of them here briefly. In 8A, which is the Mount Perrin and Lovett area, she went from 925 votes down to 757.
And you would expect that would really be a Norwood stronghold.
That would be absolutely a Norwood. These were her strongest areas. She was winning, I don't know, 90% of the vote here. In 8B, Chastain area, it was 1,170 down to 1,000. And then finally, in the OK Cafe, west of that, 8E, she went from 1,140 down to 1,073. That is a net of, just in those three precincts, y'all, 405 votes. If she had just turned out her turnout, from her vote from last time, she would have had 405 more votes just in those three precincts. So it looks like the Buckhead area did not turn out as big as it had in the past.
So conversely, there were reports earlier in the day, and of course they were totally anecdotal, that it looked like Keisha Lance Bottoms may not have been getting the turnout in the precincts that she needed in Southwest particularly. Well, that didn't quite turn out to be the case, I don't think. She ended up doing very well among the core voters that she had, didn't she?
Yeah, and a lot of the reason that we did in our polling, we were projecting a 50% white turnout, and I think it was, I don't know, 48% African-American turnout or something along these lines, and in the runoff. And so our survey, the landmark survey that was released last Friday, had Norwood ahead. And it was predicated on there being a bigger white turnout than not, because all the polling numbers and all the election results would show that white voters were basically going for Norwood, African-American voters were basically going to Bottoms. It doesn't seem that that happened, and there's two other factors that I think we're going to see. One, the Woolard's endorsement was no question helpful to Norwood, but it doesn't look like all of her people moved in that direction. There was in some of the areas that she may have done that Woolard will have done the best, she didn't probably have the impact.
East Atlanta,
that's
particularly.
Correct.
Melita, what do you make of? You're really in the heart of what should have been Norwood territory. What do you make of the possibility that she underperformed what she had done in the first election this cycle? A lack of enthusiasm? Did she finish well? Or is that a problem?
I think you had a great deal of agonized thought going on in the minds of the voters in Buckhead, say, because some of them had supported Peter, many of them had supported Kathy, and not all of them supported their endorsements of Mary Norwood. Another thing I think you have is Mark is absolutely right about turnout. If you look at the Senate District 6 race, which includes a third of City of Atlanta, you had 17,000 votes cast there. By contrast, the Senate District 39 race, Southwest Atlanta, where 65% of the voters are within the city limits, you had the turnout at more like 22,500. So you had a greater turnout between those two Senate seats in the Southwest majority black Atlanta district than you did in the more predominantly white Buckhead and Endicott County
and
district.
Yeah, and we will talk very specifically about those legislative races because they're going to have an impact as we move toward the legislative session. Now, let me first, before I invite you, Jared, and you, Dove, to weigh in on this, let me caution that Mary Norwood, as you heard, does not accept that this race is finished. She's looking at provisional ballots. How many people cast so-called provisional ballots meaning they couldn't provide necessarily, there was a problem, the proper ID, whatever, they were allowed to vote. The election board has to go back and look about whether or not these votes will be counted. She's worried about military votes. We understand, Jared, her not wanting to give up. 759 votes in a recount is a lot to try to make up. It's not as if it's 40 votes.
Well, and I think we have to look back at what happened in the last election, certainly a mirror of what we've seen here.
She lost to Kasim Reed by 715 votes in 2009.
Right. It has to be terribly disappointing. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people expect those votes to be made up. But I think we can understand where it comes from and certainly where the idea of wanting this recount would come from.
Sure. Go ahead, Melina.
I think the other thing that the close nature of this race will do is give more fuel to the fire of those who are making a push to have a return to paper ballots or verifiable paper trails for recounts.
Because paper trails rather than pure paper ballot. Electronic voting with a paper trail.
Because I do think that, you know, you haven't seen computerized voting recounts change anywhere that I know of in Georgia, but those paper trails I think will be important in the future.
Mark, did you want to weigh in on this? I thought I saw you want. Well, then let me ask you, Dove. Let me first go to you. You know, one of the things we watched for was the fact that Kasim Reed, for his entire tenure as mayor, had done a terrific job forming a partnership with Governor Nathan Deal, Democrat and Republican, holding hands, singing Kumbaya, but actually accomplishing a lot together for both the city and the state. It's no accident that Kasim Reed got deeply involved in the whole question of funding to deepen the Savannah Harbor, in part because he understood that deepening the Savannah Harbor pays benefits when cargo is moved through the state to Metro Atlanta. Now we see that Keisha Lance Bottoms, who was a protege of his, is going to take on that task. We've got to figure out whether she's going to be able to form that same partnership, whether she cares as deeply about it. Is it crucial for her to do that?
I mean, I think it's an overall benefit to the region. You know, when we think about the mayor of Atlanta, it's not just the mayor of Atlanta, but it's really the mayor of the Metro Atlanta region. And with all due respect to all of the local mayors in the surrounding cities, I mean, it really does have an impact. You know, the question's going to be not so much about her relationship with Governor Deal, but actually how the gubernatorial election plays out. I mean, we got four Republican candidates at least. We got two Democratic candidates. Her, you know, ability to work with them from the beginning, or even just to develop relationships, I think is going to be important.
Yeah, that's true. She's only got a year left with dealing with Kasim Reed, but it's a significant year.
It's a significant year, but I think one of the things that she's said is that I think the acknowledgement of working with people that didn't vote for her, I mean, it is something to say, but not everybody says it. And I think there's something valuable to be said in that. You're able to sort of it's sort of an accountability that I think will lead to it. Plus, in looking at the map, the map of how the election played out in the city of Atlanta, I mean, it really was a north-south. You know, it seemed much more to be a white versus black vote on the mayor.
It looked like split in half.
Yep.
Yeah,
and I think it's going to be really important. Of course, this is a local election, but it played out like a national election. I mean, so much of the criticism of Norwood came tying her to Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of partisanship. Of course, we had Kamala Harris coming to town, Cory Booker coming to town. I think that this is going to be a big task trying to take it down from the national sort of partisanship down into a working relationship, but it's very important.
How did women do overall in this election, Melita, since that's your sweet spot? You've got Jen Jordan. You mentioned Senate District 6, which is, that seat up there in kind
and
of north
she,
of Atlanta.
She smoked it. I mean, 64% to 39%. Nakima Williams won against another woman in Senate District 39.
Which is, for our listeners, the district, where are we talking about, basically?
Vincent Ford's district. But
right.
Even in earlier years, it was the district that Julian Bond and Horace Ward had represented. In House District 60, southern suburbs of Atlanta, Kim Schofield defeated a man 53-47%.
Let me stop you just for a sec, and then I will let you to continue. Because I want to go back to Senate District 6 briefly enough to point out, Mark, that this turns the seat over from a Republican to a Democratic district in the state Senate, right?
Yeah, it does. In Senate 6, yeah. It certainly does. And actually, one could argue quite easily here that you had contested elections across Atlanta that were actually on the partisan level were Democratic, and that ended up, as much as anything, helping Bottoms to win. If a Republican had been in that runoff against Jim Jordan, it would have made a huge difference. Because basically, if you're in Buckhead and that's the seat that is your local seat, so to speak, that where all the money is being spent was in the Senate race in Buckhead, and if that's your choice, you had a liberal and an extreme liberal. Well, if that's your choice, and if you're a Republican, it didn't incite you to vote.
So Mark throws in that there was a trend toward. I mean, we knew that we had Democrats competing against one another in a couple of districts, and it was going to be a Democrat. But it still makes it moves us more toward the potential for Democrats to succeed more than they've been able to lately. But go on with your women count.
Absolutely. And Jen Jordan's victory did close off the Senate supermajority, which was wonderful. So Kim Schofield defeated a
wonderful
man.
Wonderful if you're a Democrat. Let's point that
House
out,
House District
Melinda.
60. And then in a very big dollar for a House seat race, B. Gwynn defeated Sachin in House District 89, which is where Stacey Abrams had represented a DeKalb County district. And that primary had been the most demographically diverse race ever in the history of Georgia because you had a Vietnamese-American woman, an Indian-American man, an African-American woman, and then a Caucasian man in the Democratic primary, which we'd never had such diversity. And the Vietnamese woman, B. Gwynn, who has this amazingly beautiful backstory of her father having been a political prisoner in Vietnam, escaping that and coming to this country, raising his five beautiful daughters. He himself studied on a cardboard box as a desk when the children were little, and all of his daughters got educations. And it's just a really heartwarming story. And she knocked on so many doors to win that race.
She becomes the first Vietnamese American member of the Georgia General Assembly.
And she had managed the campaign of the first openly gay man, Sam Park, who's Korean-American, who won in Gwinnett County in 16.
Okay. So it was a good night for women candidates in general.
And it went down into, even in the school board, the Atlanta City School Board.
Oh, my gosh.
Three of the four.
Go down that far, are we?
Well, but three of the four women on the ballot won. You had
it's
mayors.
Now, the school board's now 72 women.
Yeah.
You had three women win mayor's races.
Yeah.
You even had an African-American woman win a city council seat in Smyrna, breaking the color barrier in the upper rim of the suburbs.
So Melita Easters comes away very happy and thinks the future is bright when it comes to the 2018 election cycle.
Oh, you just cannot imagine how awesome some of the women we have are who are stepping up to run for legislative seats, which have not seen competition,
well,
some of them in decades.
And Mark, there are actually going to be female Republicans who are going to be competing heavily next year, too.
I think we're seeing that, a diversification of both parties.
Yeah. Mark, what's one of the things, Greg Bluestein, who, by the way, could not be here on his Wednesday that he's usually here. He had a meeting with his paper. He had filed an interesting piece today. He said this was not a particularly successful cycle for LGBT candidates. Alex Juan, as an example, lost his race for president of the city council, one of several gay or lesbian candidates. But he pointed out a larger story there, which is maybe, and I think in a way it has something, it also fits back in with your talking about Kathy Woolard not being able to turn out East Atlanta for Norwood as a block, because a lot of that would be a gay and lesbian voting block. What it suggests is that gay and lesbian candidates are no longer being judged and voted for simply because of their sexual orientation, but on the merits. And you could say that's progress.
Well, I know that in, for example, in the air, if you take the combined vote of the white candidates from the first election and compare it to Mary's number yesterday, Mary Norwood's number yesterday, the areas that had the biggest fall off were city council districts, I believe it was 2, 3, 5, and 6, which is the DeKalb all the way over into downtown area, basically this area. So you might argue that, yes, there is some losses that took place, but there are also a number of candidates that were running. And so depending on how you look at it, that is a success.
Jared, we're going to have to take a break in a minute. So as we round out this segment, what is your most general takeaway from what you saw happen in the mayor's race in Atlanta, in the legislative races, as we head to the 2018 election cycle, where we're going to have a lot of races up for grabs? What should we learn from this?
Well, I thought what you said was very interesting. I mean, I think what we're seeing is a culture, and it's very stirring right now, is we're seeing that women and people of color and LGBTQ in elections are having incredible success, and their particular orientations isn't even important anymore. I think we're seeing a seismic shift in patriarchal, sexual, and gender relations, and I think 2018, it's really hard to even imagine what that's going to look like now, except for that it's going to be a total surprise.
All right, we got to get a break in. When we come back, we're going to turn to first President Trump and this monumental announcement that he made about Israel. And we'll do that and then move on to other big news that's taking place today after a break. This is Political Rewind.
You count on GPB to bring you reporting that helps you better understand our world. And as 2017 comes to a close, we're counting on you. Listeners make the independent journalism and all the programs that you hear possible. As you support the organizations that matter to you, please remember how much you rely on GPB. Go to gpb.org and click donate to make your tax-deductible year-end gift. And thanks so much for your support.
We're back on Political Rewind. In the studio, in the Political Rewind studio, Melita Easters is with us, Jared Yates Sexton, Dove Wilker of the American Jewish Committee, and our friend Mark Roundtree of Landmark Communications. At one little bit after one this afternoon, President Trump, Dove, made the announcement that people had been expecting for the last couple of days. It isn't as if they'd made a secret of it at the White House. Here's what President Trump said. Here's the bottom line.
After more than two decades of waivers, we are no closer to a lasting peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. It would be folly to assume that repeating the exact same formula would now produce a different or better result. Therefore, I have determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Dove, let's just make sure everybody understands what the president's talking about with the waiver. Back in during the Clinton administration, there was a vote that the capital, that the United States should move its embassy to Jerusalem and recognize Jerusalem as the official capital of Israel. But there was a waiver system put in place. Every 6 months, a president could sign a waiver saying, well, nope, not quite yet.
Yep.
And as Trump points out, every president in the years intervening has said, we are not going to move we're not going to recognize it. We're not going to move the embassy at this point. Trump actually said that he questioned the courage. It was the one sour note. There were a lot of things you might, if you don't like what he's done, not be appreciative of in the speech. But the sour note was he questioned the courage of former presidents in not doing what he's done today. But I've got that right on the waivers, don't I?
Yeah, that's correct. Every 6 months, the presidents sign anew the waiver so that they don't move, so that the embassy is not moved and that Jerusalem was not recognized. I think there's a few important things to note. First, you know, the recognition of Jerusalem as its capital is long overdue. Israel's the head of government is there, the prime minister lives there, the president lives there, the Knesset is there, many of the government ministries are there. You know, there are actually a number of countries that have embassies in the Jerusalem region. At a point, there were actually up to 16 countries that had their embassies in Jerusalem, and they succumbed to Arab pressure to relocate their embassies. And the United States also has a piece of property where they will build the embassy in an area of Jerusalem that's not up for question.
Well, they already have a consulate in Jerusalem, yes?
Correct. So the consulate is there, but the embassy is not going to be relocated to the consulate. They're right. going to build a brand new building on a beautiful piece of property.
All right. So let me throw this out, and everybody can jump in on this. Everything that Dove said is obviously correct, and Trump referred to a lot of that in his speech. But the decision not to recognize Jerusalem as the official capital and to not move the embassy there hasn't really been delayed. It's not about infrastructure, Jared. It's about a much more highly political question.
Sure. I think it's a little bit more of a blockbuster thing for the United States to announce that they're going to recognize this, obviously. And I think there's a lot of debate on this, but my concern comes from I have seen nothing in Donald Trump's administration that tells me that he takes any of this process seriously. Of course, his first thing was he installed his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, Dove's former high school classmate, to be in charge, who had absolutely no expertise, no experience, and, you know, in his spare time, I guess he was going to restructure the government as well. I have no faith that this is being taken the way it needs to with the respect and caution that it does.
Go ahead.
I mean, the one thing I would say is, you know, from the beginning, the president made it clear that he refers to this as the ultimate deal. And to me, and in my perspective, it's really about what's the first step in helping to get a deal done. You know, and he made it very clear. I mean, if it's a two-state solution that the parties are able to come to, then that's what, you know, that's what it'll be. My organization, American Jewish Committee, believes in a two-state solution. I would just say, I think as a first step to pushing, he made a statement, different or better result. Try something different, getting a different result, you know, why not?
Well, the timing, however, coming just before the Alabama election as a bone to the Christian right in Alabama and as a way of diverting attention from Roy Moore's unfortunate sexual predator past is suspicious. I agree with Jared that I'm not so certain President Trump is capable of the kind of nuanced thought process that should be behind such a decision. Whether the decision is right or not, the nuanced thought process that he seems incapable of is what worries many people and our allies who called for him not to make this decision. I'm not debating the merits of the decision. I'm merely stating I don't believe much thought went into the decision
I do think, stripped of some of what I thought was her fierce partisan talk, which is perfectly fine, that's your role. There is a question, is there not, Dove, as whether there's any strategic thinking about this or whether this is Trump acting impulsively and, as Melita suggested, acting on behalf of the evangelicals who supported his campaign. He told them he was going to do this. And maybe even more important, some of his wealthiest Jewish donors like Sheldon Adelson and Bernie Marcus right here in Atlanta. I guarantee you Bernie Marcus must be standing up and cheering this afternoon.
Look, I can't comment on the thought process of Bernie Marcus or Sheldon Adelson or on the evangelical Christian community, as I am not a part of that
at
either.
At least not in your role at AJC.
Definitely not in my role at AJC. Look, I think the strategy behind this, you know, the relationship between, it is no secret about Israel's relationship now with Saudi Arabia, right? It is no secret of the Saudi Arabian disdain for Iran. It is no secret that the United States does not think highly of the Iranian regime. You know, this is not, you know, on the one hand, it was notification, but I have no doubt that this was, you know, those parties, our allies in the region, our historic allies in the region, are not surprised by this. And I think one of the things that we will see is what the reaction will be on the Arab street. You know, the Palestinians and Jordanians came out and declared that there would be 3 days of rage. Well, where's the condemnation of that? I mean, they just essentially declare that they're going to begin protesting. It will likely turn violent. Unfortunately, you know, past historic actions are not necessarily a predictor of future. But, you know, why isn't the world coming out and condemning the beginning of the fact that the Palestinians are declaring rage at an announcement that doesn't, by the way, preclude them from having a state in East, a capital in East Jerusalem?
Well, Mark, what I think is interesting, too, though, is the president began making phone calls to leaders in the Middle East days ago. And the reporting has it that virtually every leader, the Saudis, the Jordan in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan, the Pope, who didn't get the call, among others, said, "Don't do this. You are throwing a possible bomb into the middle of what's already an impossibly tense situation."
Yes. At the same time, I don't think Trump actually has that much regard for international allies or enemies. I think he has a regard. He always said America first. And I think that this is politically a significant win in the United States for Trump within the electorate of the United States. There is virtually no there's no major movement to keep the capital of Israel in Tel Aviv. No, I mean, how many of you actually know anybody that cares, really, if it's Tel Aviv? But there is a significant upside to moving it to Jerusalem because it's very symbolic. It's, you could say, and very, maybe so, Melita or one of y'all pointed out, maybe this is sort of a, is there a strategic point here? Is this, or is this almost just like, hey, flag burning moment, and we talk about the flag to divert from something else? I don't know that that's it. This is something that he committed to. This isn't just, you know, throwing out a comment about Roseanne Barr. This is a, I think this was something that he has actually been committed to for a number of years, said he would do it and has done it. And I think it's going to be politically quite popular in the United States.
I think what's going to be interesting, Jared, is what's the next step? What underlies all of this? Does he have a strategy as he moves forward, having said that? He sort of hinted at what he thinks might be that strategy, which is if you take this off the table, then we can move forward with other intractable issues that need to be resolved. On the other hand, this is always the status of Jerusalem has always been considered part of the final status talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
You know, Bill, I'm sitting here thinking about the last time I was in studio. It was the day that he tweeted out the transgender ban in the military, just out of nowhere, without telling anybody anything. Unfortunately, I can't sit here and say the president has any plan or any idea of how to move forward on this. I hope that he's not just throwing a bomb into the streets, as you were saying, but I don't have a lot of faith in that.
So here's what, Dove, I want to play something that he said and get you first to react to it. You know, we are used to hearing the criticism of President Trump as being a nationalist, being, you know, fomenting bigotry against minorities in this country, that sort of thing. I think that Tom Faust and I, our producer Tom and I, were both kind of struck by one of the lines in his speech today in which President Trump suddenly became a global religious thinker.
Over the past seven decades, the Israeli people have built a country where Jews, Muslims, and Christians, and people of all faiths are free to live and worship according to their conscience and according to their beliefs. Jerusalem is today and must remain a place where Jews pray at the Western Wall, where Christians walk the Stations of the Cross, and where Muslims worship at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
You know, Dove, what's interesting about that is he got it just right when it comes to Jerusalem being the meeting place of the three major religions.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, and I think one of the things that it points out is the vibrancy of Israeli democracy. I mean, Israel, you know, freedom of religion in Israel is not freedom of, it's not just about Judaism. You know, there's Jewish courts, there's Christian courts, there are Muslim courts. So religious law, it's not that Judaism is the religious law of the land, but really it's about the religion that you practice. And for the president to acknowledge the fact that Israel is an open democracy like that, that allows for religious practice, there's a lot of countries in the regions that don't.
Okay, so that said, Melita, if you are an Arab living in Israel, Dove is absolutely correct. Freedom to worship as you choose. If you're a Palestinian living in the West Bank and for whatever reason want to visit with your family on Islamic holy days, getting to see them in Jerusalem can be a little trickier proposition, and that's part of the problem that we're dealing with here.
Well, what we're dealing with is a president who obviously practiced reading from his teleprompter before he made those remarks.
Are you talking about Obama again?
So, okay. But here's what I thought, and this is just personal observation. Dove has been to Jerusalem, certainly. I don't know. You probably have. No, Melita? I don't know if anybody else has. But it is certainly
true. Got to get you all to Israel.
That's right. It is certainly true that one of the most remarkable things about being in the city of Jerusalem is you can stand at the Western Wall, the remnant of the Second Temple, and you can hear the old Jewish men praying in Hebrew. And if you're there at the right moment, a Muslim cleric goes up to the prayer tower at Al-Aqsa, which is right above the Western Wall, and chants the call to prayer in Arabic. And down the street, maybe the bells in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is where Jesus is supposed to have been buried, all happen at the same moment. Jared, you know, we talk about the politics so much, but the mystical and incredibly important nature of that as a religious, as a place unlike any other on the earth in terms of religion is really something.
So what you're talking about is like one of the most like nuanced cultures in the world, right? And it's this tinderbox. And what concerns me is, I mean, we have a president who posted anti-Muslim videos just a few days ago. And for this person to, you know, post what it was, Islamophobic videos a couple of days ago and then come out and do this, it really concerns me. And this is such a delicate situation. And I think that you could make something good happen here, but I just don't trust that this is the person to do it.
Well, so I would just say it's not about the president being the person to do it. If he's made a declaration about Jerusalem as capital, perhaps it is the difference that will make other people, because it's about, you know, he's not the implementer. The president is not going to be the one who's drawing up the plans. It's going to be the Israelis and the Palestinians, and how are their leaderships able to come together to resolve this? And maybe this is going to push the Israelis and Palestinians to come together.
Well, are we saying that the United States is not going to continue to play its role as the most important actor in trying to win peace?
No, not at all. I think it's not about what the United States' role is. It'll continue, I think, to play a very strong role. But it's, you know, you had mentioned earlier, Jared Kushner has sort of been designated with Jason Greenblatt as the leaders of this negotiation. So I think they're the ones who are going to be pushing on it.
All right, wait. Did you actually go to high school with Jared Kushner?
I actually went to high school with Jared Kushner.
Do you want to give us any insights?
I got nothing for you. He's a year older than me. I remember passing him in the halls.
All right. I apologize for diverting on a serious subject, but I do think it's interesting you knew him in high school. I do want to play one last soundbite from President Trump, because it's probably the linchpin of the whole speech that he gave today, and that there are those, Mark Rountree, who think that he blew up the peace process by making this decision today. But here's what President Trump said about that.
This decision is not intended in any way to reflect a departure from our strong commitment to facilitate a lasting peace agreement. We are not taking a position of any final status issues, including the specific boundaries of the Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem or the resolution of contested borders. Those questions are up to the parties involved. So today we call for calm, for moderation, and for the voices of tolerance to prevail over the purveyors of hate. Our children should inherit our love, not our conflicts.
President Trump, just about an hour and 45 minutes ago. So we will watch in the weeks and months ahead, perhaps the years ahead, to see what this decision truly does in terms of relations in the Middle East. And whether you are a big Trump supporter or whether you wish he would get out of office as soon as possible, there's no one who I can imagine hopes that this, in fact, blows up a region that's already facing such difficulties. Let's take our second and final break of the show. When we come back, we got a lot more still to talk about.
Support for GPB comes from you, our listeners, and Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport and the Canopy Construction Project that will increase efficiency and change the face of the busiest airport in the world. For more information, visit next.atl.com.
On the next Fresh Air.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
That's a now famous line from a film considered one of the best worst films ever made, The Room. We'll talk with James Franco about directing and starring in the new film, The Disaster Artist, about the making of The Room. Join us.
Fresh Air is coming up this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Now that we have the off-year elections in Atlanta and in legislative districts and in some municipal races in Georgia finished as of last night, the next big race we are going to turn and look at here at Political Rewind, and of course have already been talking about it, is the special Senate election in Alabama. Roy Moore continues to be a subject of great controversy. President Trump, as recently as yesterday, he'd already said he has already endorsed him against the wishes of many leaders in his own party and even against the wishes of some in the White House. He doubled down again yesterday.
I think he's going to do very well. We don't want to have a liberal Democrat in Alabama, believe me. We want strong borders. We want stopping crime. We want to have the things that we represent, and we certainly don't want to have a liberal Democrat that's controlled by Nancy Pelosi and controlled by Chuck Schumer. We don't want to have that for Alabama. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Mark, you do most of your work for Republican candidates. This notion that giving your support, whether it's President Trump or Republicans on the Hill who refuse to speak out strongly against him, for a candidate who is an alleged child molester, who people on the Hill like Mitch McConnell have said, yes, I believe the stories of these women. What does this do in the long run to the Republican Party as it turns its support to Roy Moore, and especially if he wins next week, which many people think he will?
Well, you could say that the same exact question about Menendez in New Jersey. I think as far as the Republican Party, it has zero impact. As far as, allowing some criticism or having a situation where there's justified criticism of Roy Moore. There's plenty. But, right now you have a New Jersey U.S. senator who has, I don't want to libel or slander anyone, but there are much worse allegations about that U.S. senator than against Roy Moore. Now, not to compare the two, but that is a fact that there is great criticism. And where is this? The guy was indicted. Where were the calls to resign?
They all need to go.
All
of them.
I don't disagree.
Roy Moore is a stain on the Republican Party, and Roy Moore is a stain on America.
Menendez, say that too.
Sure. Get them all out.
Well, say it. No, you said him. Say it. Say his name.
I think Al Franken should resign.
Okay, Menendez.
I think anybody who has a complaint against them that has shown that they are with misconduct, I don't care what party I am, these people need to go. And Roy Moore, and quite frankly, the RNC has just started funding Moore again after cutting off their funding. Donald Trump, it might even rally with him tomorrow in Pensacola. This is an embarrassment, and I think that this is going to be a stain on the history of the Republican Party and a stain on this period of time in America, the whole thing.
You know, what's interesting about this particular race is there has been a lot of volatility in the polls. I mean, I'm just sitting here looking at Real Clear Politics. I was just pulling it up to make it current. Most of the polls, once again, have Roy Moore leading. Not by a lot, and not by a majority. Most don't have a majority, but you know. But there's interesting one, Gravis, which is Republican-leaning firm. They have it now, 4 points for Jones. But most of these polling companies, including CBS, has and YouGov has it for.
I think it's been pretty clear that what Mark is saying is correct, Melita. The trend as the race closes. It does look like it's Roy Moore who is gaining some momentum in the race. And President Trump in Pensacola tomorrow night or Friday night will certainly speak on his behalf. So we may very well have a Roy Moore in the United States Senate.
And Roy Moore is problematic not just because he's a sexual predator, but because of his earlier clashes about placing the Ten Commandments in the Alabama Supreme Court. He is a man who has no respect for the rule of law. But Roy Moore's candidacy begs the question, forget about Happy Holidays versus Merry Christmas. Roy Moore makes people wonder where the Christ is in some Christians, those who would put the political expediency of the Republican Party and the votes in the U.S. Senate above the principles that religion should be focused on protecting children.
Yeah, I want to move on, but one response, Mark, what I'm interested in terms of your comment is you're going to represent probably some Republican candidates in the 2018 cycle, maybe not congressional candidates, but it does seem to me that Roy Moore could very well be hung around the neck of any Republican running at almost any level, certainly state, legislative level and up. And that's not going to be helpful for your candidates, is it?
I think if they try to make Roy Moore an issue for some state legislative campaign in LaGrange, Georgia, they are all so far off message in trying to win. I would. You only get so many attacks in a campaign that people will listen to. And if you're that far out, then you're not talking about LaGrange, Georgia, or you're not talking about, you know, Augusta or whoever, you're off message. I don't agree with this theory that somehow this is going to have some national detrimental effect on Republicans. They're going to have the Republicans are going to get hurt in 2018, but it really won't be because of Roy Moore.
Okay, let's move on. In the same vein, though, all of a sudden today, it already came up. Jared, you already mentioned Al Franken. We now have any number of Democratic female members of the United States Senate, led by Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, saying Al Franken has to go. And apparently there was a final straw this week when yet another young woman, a woman who was a junior staffer, I think, when Al Franken was just a radio guy. She was there to do his show when he was on the air. Her boss was on the show. And she contends that after the boss left, Franken made a move on her is about the best I can say. So we've come to a remarkable place when a guy who we thought was going to be a strong candidate or certainly an interesting candidate for president in 2020 may tomorrow, which is when he's going to talk about this, be forced to resign.
Well, and he should resign. As much as he has been an eloquent voice for many liberal and progressive causes, he needs to go and clear the way for that governor to appoint another progressive Democrat who may not speak as well as he has, but can at least not have a stain on their reputation moving forward.
Jared, I can't help but wonder. Certainly, there are reasons, just in terms of Al Franken himself, you might say he should go. But I can't help but wonder whether some of this is motivated by Democrats who recognize you cannot continue to attack Roy Moore if you're not willing to clean your own house. In other words, to some extent, is Al Franken getting a bank shot from the Roy Moore controversy?
Well, if we're going to speak frankly, I think Franken and certainly Conyers have gotten a little bit too much time, and they've gotten a little bit too much cover from the party, certainly playing partisan politics. I think that this should be a clear message that patriarchal abuse and bad behavior, it doesn't know party lines, it doesn't know age, race, gender, any of it. It needs to go. He needs to go.
I would have respectfully, an actual question for Melita. You mentioned that give the opportunity to a progressive governor in Minnesota to pick a new U.S. senator. What if that was a Republican governor in Minnesota? Should Franken resign?
Probably.
Why so much weaker? Why probably and not yes?
And Franken needs to go.
And that's the partisan thing that we're acknowledging. It's just that everybody thinks it's regarding the other party. You know, the Republicans are backing more because they are concerned about a Democrat winning in Alabama, just as your initial reaction. And I don't mean this as any kind of comment about you. I'm just saying your initial reaction was a little bit weaker than Franken should go. And then it became probably. And it's just a commentary on the general nature of partisanship. I think all of us feel it, and it's hard to overcome.
I would just add, one thing I'd add is I wish for every one of these members of Congress who end up resigning that they replace them with a female.
I'd love that.
I mean, I'm just saying, it's been something I've thought about as I've seen it sort of across the board with all of the newscasters and everyone else. I'd say, you know, it's one way sort of to show a response. It's not, you know, it's never going to be foolproof, but it's one way.
Well, the other thing is, once the, quote, liberal media clean house, as they have been doing, networks on down, once the movie industry, entertainment industry, cleans house, as they have been doing.
They're the worst.
Then perhaps we can even look at the predator in chief.
All right. You get the last word on this broadcast today, Melita, because we are out of time.
The last word is about Clinton?
The last word.
I guess. What, now Melita does get the last word again. All right, I'm going to call a halt to it because I've got to get out of the show today. Melita Easters, Dove Wilker, Jared Yates Sexton, whose book is The People Are Going to Rise Like the Waters Upon Your Shore, going into its third printing and soon to be out in paperback. And Mark Roundtree,
thank you
all so much
for being here today.
I want to just one quick comment before we leave you. You know, it's funny. I spent probably 30 years of my professional life watching elections, commenting on, analyzing elections, sitting on the sets of TV newscasts in Atlanta, Channel 2 for 20 years. And now my elections consist of social media, digital. I tweet all night, which means I get to sit at home in my jeans and a t-shirt and yet still cover it. And the only reason I bring this up is that I'm grateful to all of you out there who listen to this show and who follow us on Twitter. You made last night much more engaging for us. And you know what? When you're on TV, nobody gets to talk back. And the fact that when we tweet out an election, as Tom Faust and I did last night, and we actually get you to weigh in, it really makes for a much more exciting and meaningful election night. So thank you to all of you who follow us at Politics GPB. Please keep doing it. You make our jobs a lot more meaningful and interesting. Thank you, Olivia Rheingold. Thank you, Tyler Morris. Thank you, Tom Faust, for your work in putting today's show together. And thank you all out there for listening. I'm personally going to go home and take a really long nap. We'll see you again on Friday for Political Rewind, but tomorrow on Two Way Street, we're going to do a show that's pegged to the 76th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack. It's a really, really interesting show, which will teach you new things that you didn't know about what happened at Pearl. I'm Bill Nygut. Take care.